Thanks, Shane. Thank you very much.
It's the Ray Dassey Show on RTE Radio 1. Enjoy the show.
Thanks, Dermot. Good afternoon on this Wednesday afternoon. How are you? I'm only coming out through one ear there. Something wrong there. Yeah. 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Now, I was just hearing that a lot of people are watching Quinn Country. Three nights, amazing series of documentaries. The last one's on tonight, telling the story of Sean Quinn and how he rose from a guy who left school very early to become a billionaire and listed on the world's, I think he was 117th richest man in the world at one stage, the richest man in Ireland. And I suppose a lot of people are watching it because they want to figure out why we are still paying 2% levy on our insurance. Any non-life insurance policies in the state have a levy of 2% on them because of what happened to Quinn Insurance and his gambling and his risk-taking. They reckon it's going to cost $1.65 billion to repay over a number of years. That could bring us up into the 2030s. We'll still be paying it. So it's great to see the people who know laying it out in front of us as to how that happened. And reminder then that we are still paying for his mistakes. Anyway, the last one's on tonight. And if you didn't see the first two, which were on Monday and Tuesday night, you can catch up on the RTE player. Now, this is an annual thing. Ireland's favourite dog names have been revealed. The top 10 names in no particular order: Buddy, Bonnie, Cooper, Coco, Toby, Millie, Bella, Teddy, Bailey, Luna. We have a Teddy at home. A dog, Teddy, yeah. Luna, yeah, that's a nice one. Cooper, wonder where that came from. Coco, Bonnie, Buddy. They're all nice names. You might remember last June we spoke to Madeleine Flint in Walsh Island. She was telling us about a special charity run taking place for Crumlin Hospital. It was a run with a difference because it involved a motorised bar stool. And we first came across the motorised bar stool on the RTE Archives website. Somebody did a report on it on one of those nationwide type programmes back in the 70s or 80s. Anyway, we spoke to Madeleine a couple of times and she told us about the trip on the motorised bar stool and all her friends who were helping her out and all their nicknames. And she got back onto us to ray@rte.ie. She says, "Hi Ray and team, at long last we have a closure on our amazing bar stool run." So I think it was her dad had put a motor into the bar stool and wheels and it operated like that. Anyway, last May we started with the help from your listeners and lots of great friends to run the Honda 50. Oh, there is Honda 50 bar stool, along with some real Honda 50s from Kildare, Edenderry and local areas of Walsh Island, County Offaly, to Arranmore Island in County Donegal, 187 miles. So on the 9th of June to the 12th, we headed off on our journey. It was amazing. Great friends were made, great laughs were had. The whole 4 days went by with no problems. We all got home safe and sound. Well, Ray, we finally handed the money over to Crumlin Hospital, a cheque for €22,235. Well done, everybody. When we set out to do this run, we gave ourselves a target of €5,000, so we were more than happy with our total. Well, you should be more than four times happy with your total. And a massive thank you to all your listeners. I'm sorry I didn't get in touch earlier, but in September, I lost my wonderful mum. Sorry to hear that. So do forgive me for the late email. A big thank you also to all the lads and ladies that travelled to Donegal, to all the musicians that entertain us along the way, to all who done the bucket collection, the sponsorship, the sponsored cards. Also thanks to Johnny B's B&B in Bally Buffet. A lot of B's there. They gave us 26 free chicken curries. And to Seamus and Bomber from Blue Ferry, who took us to Arranmore. And to the gang in Philbin's Pub, Tommy and Marion there, musicians Maeve Walsh, Paddy Mangan, Eddie the Gorgeous Kane, and especially to Boots, who arranged the whole event. And I believe we will do it again in 2 years' time. Bigger and better. Thanks again from Madeleine Flint. The Rev Limiter. That was still is Madeleine's nickname from Walsh Island. That's great. 22,000 for Our Lady's Hospital Crumlin. Well done, everybody. 51551 ray@rte.ie. I must tell you about our Christmas show, which is happening on the 9th of December. And we're looking for you to be in the audience. Now, we've had loads of interest in this. So this is the last call out we're doing for it. We're broadcasting live from Dublin Castle on December 9th. Christmas at the Castle. Sounds lovely. It'll be a fantastic live show with wonderful guests, mulled wine, mince pies, a few surprises and loads of festivities. We'll be broadcasting from the Bedford Hall in Dublin Castle, which is a lovely big room, and we'll have it festooned with Christmas decorations and tinsel and lights and trees and all sorts of things. And all that we lack is an audience, and that's where you come into it. So if you're available on that day, December 9th, it's a Friday, we'll want you to be there for about 2 o'clock, and you'll be finished and ready to go at 4:30. And the Christmas market is happening in Dublin Castle that day as well, so you'll have loads to do before and after the show. So if you want to be in the audience, rte.ie/Ray and fill in the application form. No point in emailing us. Fill in the application form. There's a couple of questions about your favourite Christmas story, your worst Christmas present, things like that, and then your demographic details, and fill it in, and we could be in contact with you in the coming week to let you know that you'll be in the audience. And we are really looking forward to that. Now, the four-day week, you might have heard on Morning Ireland this morning, there's new research been published about companies, 12 companies who were involved in a pilot study over the last 6 months on the four-day week. And we spoke to people a few years ago about it, so we're having that person back on. And we're going to be asking questions like, why is it a five-day week? Like, how did that happen in history? Why can't we have a three-day week or a two-day week? It's all very arbitrary, it would seem. And if you have any notions about the five-day week, or if you're working a four-day week and you want to comment, do get onto us, 51551 array@rte.ie. I see the French baguette has got UNESCO heritage status. I would have thought it had it already, but UNESCO experts are gathering in Morocco this week, and they decided that the long French bread, made only from flour, water, salt and yeast, deserves UN recognition. The move comes after France's culture ministry warned of a continuous decline in the number of traditional bakeries, with some 400 closing every year over the past half a century. Now, I'm wondering if it's getting UNESCO heritage status. Does that mean when we go into a shop now, we can't ask for a baguette? Because only the ones that are produced in France can be called baguettes, the same way as only Blaz produced in Waterford can be called Blaz, and only champagne produced in Champagne can be called champagne. It has to be called sparkling wine if it's made outside of the Champagne region of France. That's the UNESCO heritage status. That's what it means. So that'll be interesting to see. Not that it's going to change it, the breakfast roll for anybody, because I doubt that many people ask for a baguette when they're asking for a breakfast roll. Please, 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 can you wish our work colleague Dennis Sherwin a happy 65th birthday today, 30th November. Best wishes to him from all his mates in Renus in Blanchardstown. We have three dogs, a Billy, a Bella and a King Charles. And the King Charles is called Darcy, says Matthew. So Billy, Bella and the King Charles called Darcy. 51551 ray@rte.ie. I will tell you about our quiz in a moment, but first this. Dusty Springfield and Son of a Preacher Man. Now, we're looking for two of you to come on after 4 o'clock and answer the three questions each on bits of songs, news reports, TV shows and movies. It's called our Reeling in the Ears quiz, and we have a prize, which is a two-night stay for two people in the Fota Island Resort. Relax in luxury in one of the gorgeous suites overlooking 780 acres of lush countryside. Unwind at Fota Island Spa or experience a game of golf on one of their three magnificent championship golf courses. There are also many dining options. You're very close to Cork City, or you can go east and go to Ballycotton and places like that. Fotaisland.ie, Fotaisland.ie to find out what's in store for you. Here is today's qualifying question. Matilda the Musical has opened in the cinemas. Is it based on a book by Roald Dahl or David Walliams? Matilda the Musical, is it based on a book by Roald Dahl or David Walliams? 0818 715 925. 0818 715 925, and good luck with that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
0818 715 925 if you want to get involved in our quiz today. Matilda the Musical has opened in the cinemas. Is it based on a book by Roald Dahl or David Walliams? And good luck with that. Now, Lots of reaction today in relation to a new Forrester research project that saw a four-day working week being trialled across 12 businesses here in Ireland with very positive results. Back in 2021, we spoke to one man who had already adopted this approach with the company that he worked for. His name is Tom Cranley from ICE Group, and Tom is on the line again. How are you doing, Tom?
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me on.
Good to talk to you. And we also have Dr. Laura Bambrick, Head of Social Policy and Social Affairs with ICTU, on the line. Hello, Laura.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Tom.
Now, Laura, we'll go to you first because we want to find out about the history of the five-day week and how it came about, and is it an arbitrary thing or is there a reason for it?
Great, Ray. So I'm sure many listeners will have listened to the research this morning and thought, wow, a four-day week, that sounds really attractive, but really it's not going to be achievable. But the good news is, not so long ago, the weekend seemed like an unrealistic goal. So we have to go back really 200 years. And why 200 years? Well, that was really the start of industrialization, when more and more of us stopped working the land and we started working in factories. And around the 1800s, employers wanted to maximize their profits. And to do that, they had their factories open 24 hours a day. So workers, including very young children, and because there wasn't a pension, you were working up until the day you died. So really elderly people, no maternity cover, so heavily pregnant women, were working on average around a 16-hour day. And they were doing this 6 days a week. You only got Sunday off as a religious day. So around then the 1820s, you had a factory owner, because a lot of the time this is driven by factory owners who are also social reformers. And he was able to show that, in fact, by not employing children and having the workers work a shorter day, that his factory could still make a profit. And that began the start of a campaign for the 8-hour day. And if listeners think about the day in the 24-hour clock, what his logic was, you worked 8 hours, then you had that second 8-hour slice of the day for recreation, for leisure time, and then the third 8 hours to rest, to sleep. But then that began, as I said, a 200-year campaign to get us where we are today. So initially, we seen a ban on children under the age of 9 being allowed to be employed in factories. And then children between 9 and 16, they were allowed only work a mere 12-hour day. So the next big win then we had for teenagers and women by the 1840s, they were able to work the 12-hour day as well. Mm. However, it was a big strike, in fact, up in Belfast, because listeners might be aware that Belfast at the time was a big shipbuilding, big industrialised city. And 40,000 engineering and shipbuilding workers went out on strike. And that began an explosion of strikes around the UK at the time. And that led to the 47-hour week. But that wasn't in legislation. And it was only 25 years ago that we had the first piece of legislation limiting the maximum number of hours we work. And that did two things. It said we couldn't work on average more than 48 hours, but it also set out what rest periods we can have. So listeners might be familiar that if you do a 4.5-hour shift, you have to have a 15-minute break, or if you do a 6-hour thing. But it also, that piece of legislation said, once a week, you must have at least 35 consecutive hours off. And that is where, back in 1997, is when we officially have the weekend. So only 25 years ago, Ray.
Yeah, but I was doing a bit of research on this, and the first time weekend was mentioned was in an English magazine in 1879. But it wasn't in law. It wasn't in law.
It wasn't in law. And listeners of Downton Abbey, big fan myself, they will be familiar with the idea of it being mentioned and one of the main characters saying, "What is a weekend?" Like the idea of why would the servants need anything more than Sunday to go to church and back home to visit their family. So it was up until 1997, it was through the good favour of your employer in the terms and the terms of your contract of employment. But it was only when the EU stepped in and said, look, there's health and safety concerns here around when people work, and if they're overworked, they're a danger to themselves and they're a danger to other people that come into contact with them, because they're more likely to cause workplace accidents. And it was health and safety legislation that drove the limits on the working week the minimum rest periods we can have.
And Laura, it sounds, as you outline it there, that we've arrived to where we are today by accident rather than by design. So there's no real reason that it's a 40-hour as opposed to a 50 or a 15 or a 25-hour week.
Well, 48 hours, it is based on people that, as I said, the need
yes,
for
the
rest.
8 hours,
When you, so there is a lot of science around it.
No.
And I should say that even though that the 48 hours is the maximum, on average today, an EU worker would work 41 hours. And of course, that's less for trade union members, but it's also less depending on the type of work you work in. Obviously, if you're working maybe with hazardous waste, or in certain environments, you can only work for a reduced number because of the consequences of you not concentrating. But on average, the EU worker now is working the 40-41 hour week.
Maybe in hundreds of years' time, Tom, you'll be seen, and your fellow workers will be seen as pioneers of the 4-day week. Because as you outlined it there, Laura, things are changing all the time and evolving. So Tom, when did you start working the 4-day week?
So we moved in July of 2019. We kind of found out as a bit of a surprise, a shock, in May of 2019. And even as Laura says there, the good grace of our employer, instead of having a 2-day weekend, we moved to a 3-day weekend. So the 4-day week concept was brought in there, and we did a 5 to 6 month trial and stuck with it ever since, you know, even through the pandemic and everything like that. I think it actually kind of set us up pretty well for it, because we had adapted a lot of different systems and different work patterns, and people were, you know, much more competent and doing different roles or doing them at different times.
So the business is open 5 days a week, but you all just work 4 days.
Exactly, yeah. So I work Monday to Thursday, and like there's a team of two in my department, so the other person in my department works Tuesday to Friday. So the whole week is covered.
And how many hours a day do you work?
So I work a 9-hour day. I do 8 to 5:30. So it's a 36-hour week. We'd be hoping to bring it down to 32 eventually, but we're starting at 36 for now.
That's the plan, is it?
That is, yeah.
I see that 9 out of 12 companies said they were committed to continuing with the 4-day week schedule in the 4-hour research. And when asked to rate their experience of the 4-day week on a scale of 1 to 10, the average rating for the trial was 9.2. which is very good. So for our listeners, and it won't suit every industry, obviously, Tom, but you work in recruiting, so it sort of suits how you work. Just so you have every Friday off?
Every Friday off. We have a small little caveat there where we say if it's a bank holiday Monday, we'll work the Friday, but that means I get a 4-day weekend coming up before that. So there's swings and roundabouts and positives all over the place.
Hold on now. So you can't take the Friday before a bank holiday off, but then they give you
it's
another Friday somewhere else.
Yeah.
They give you another Monday somewhere
else.
Is that it? All right.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. So I know it's hard to compare, because you don't know what you would have been like if you continued to do a 5-day week. But have you noticed any changes? So it's your 3 years going now at the 4-day week.
Yeah. Well, like I worked 4 years in the same job before we started this, and now I'm 3 years into this one. I think we're much better off. I think we're much more productive. And then, the personal side, from a well-being side, I have a lot more time for doing different things, whether it's through sports or I went back to college, do different things like that. So, yeah, there's definitely much more positives in it. So I think I'd be in a much better place.
And everybody is still doing it and totally behind it.
Yeah, exactly. Like we just actually had a survey there recently. The HR department do it every couple of months. And, you know, we were still in the 90% people still very happy with it, same as the survey that went out. And we're always looking to make sure we're doing the right thing and everyone's, you know, feeling happy. You know, the saying in HR is focus, energize and happy. So if we're taking those three boxes, we're doing pretty well.
Focus, energize and happy.
Yeah.
Stay where you are, Tom. Back to Laura. Laura, of course, how we work has changed in a huge way over the last 200 years. And technology has taken over a lot of the menial jobs that humans would have been doing with robots, etc. So does it mean we should be asking more and more questions about how we structure our work life?
Oh, absolutely. But technology is also making, chipping away at the wins we have won around the short working week. Because as you know, Ray, we all have a computer in our pocket now, in our phone. So we're contactable everywhere we go. We have different devices for contacting us, whether it's, you know, email, Slack, instant messenger machines, WhatsApp groups and things like that. So the separation between when we're in work and when is that leisure time. So the line is blurred between those 8 hours work and 8 hours recreation. So technology, workers should be seeing the benefit of it. And as Tom mentioned there, they have systems in place. And I'm sure technology is driving a lot of that, helping them work smarter. But at the other end, technology, if we don't have that right to disconnect, that time where we don't feel pressurized to answer that email, to take that call out of hours, obviously there will be times when it has to be taken. But if that is becomes the norm, that you find yourself having to be online and contactable out of your hours, that is chipping away this sense of division between work time, rest time and leisure time. So yes, technology does facilitate us to work smarter, not harder, but it has to be reined in. We have to put the we have to put the brakes on it.
Yeah. How do you legislate for that, the right to disconnect?
Well, we had recently there, April 1st, 2 years it will be, that we brought in a code of practice around that. And while it does set out that, you know, workers shouldn't feel pressurised, not only shouldn't feel pressurised to do it, but shouldn't be penalised if they don't answer calls and emails out of hours. But an interesting part of that code of practice is that as a co-worker, we should be respectful of our colleagues' time. So while it might suit me to work flexible and it might suit my home life that I work into the early hours of the morning, if I'm shoving off emails and maybe that ping is coming into somebody's phone while they're sleeping because they didn't turn off their phone, I now have to take a responsibility to be fair to people and put a delay send on that email. So it is a part of a new conversation where flexibility might work for you, but you have to be conscious of that your flexibility isn't imposing onto other people's rest time. So it is an ongoing conversation, but government have taken the lead on this and have designed a code of practice around how we work and work around technology.
And some organisations have on top of the email that this person, something to the effect of this person may not be working at this particular time. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. So we have it at the byline of our email saying, these are my hours. It suits me to email you. Yeah. Please don't feel that. Please don't feel you need to contact me.
Right.
Let me go into my email. So my byline said, I'm currently working flexibly. So while it suits me to email you now, I do not expect a response or action outside of your own working hours.
Right. Okay.
And that's, you just hope that people will know that, because, you know, a lot of people do work part-time hours now or might work, you know, split shifts and things like that. So it's just a respect for them to say, suits me to email you now. and I await your response when you're back in the office. So just a common courtesy.
Yeah. And what about you, Tom? Do you have to let people know that you're on a 4-day week and you have every Friday off? Sorry, I'm just going to say that again.
Yeah, we had to get that one in. But we do. We have like a standard out of office will help us, you know, that's in... Like we have what we call our day off, as you'd say, we call it our genius day.
Oh, your which day?
Our genius day.
Oh, your genius day.
So we do something smart.
Right.
Yeah, whether you go back to college or you make some better use of your time.
And you did, what did you do?
I did go back to college, yeah.
Yeah.
And I did a master's, so like that counts as being a genius in some ways, I suppose. Yeah. But like in our out of office, and it'll say, you know, it's my genius day, I'll be back on Monday or whichever a person has it set up. So even internally, that sometimes we might forget who's off, we'll know, you know, that person is going to respond when they come back.
And
just like Laura says.
Does it exaggerate then the Monday effect if you're off for 3 days every week?
I think it exaggerates the whole weekend effect that you come back and relaxed.
Oh, you know, dear, it's right, still, yeah.
You know, you still have to go in and do your 4 days of work, regardless of whether there's something busy there or not. But you're coming in refreshed and you're coming in having that big break, you know, from sitting at your desk or looking through emails and stuff. And you're ready to go again.
Because I was reading there historically, Laura, and you might put me right on this. There's probably loads of theories about Saint Monday.
Yes, so people outside Dublin and the big urban centres might be familiar, like in a lot of the towns, maybe the hardware store or the grocers, they wouldn't open on a Monday. So they would have done, their 5 days would have been Monday to Saturday, but they would have done a longer day, maybe on Friday, which was the mart day, and then Saturday, which was the main shopping day. So their rest days, and in often case, it's still the same. Like if listeners listening in will know that it can be very difficult maybe getting a hairdresser on Monday and Tuesday, because still Saturday is their busy day. And a lot of the well sought after stylists, it's very hard to get them on a Monday and Tuesday. So really what they were doing is they were ahead of the time of this EU directive around working time, is they were taking their weekend was Sunday and Monday. It wasn't the traditional
Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, they were ahead of their time.
Until the 4-day cow was invented, farmers can't take a 4-day week offer, says Adekunle Gomez. How are you doing, Adekunle? And how come it's all office work that can miraculously be done in 4 days instead of 5? Makes us tradespeople wonder, says Brendan. And only in the highly unaccountable public sector or in the high profit, low labour tech sector is this possible. How's this going to work in hospitals, retail, hospitality without adding another 20% onto payroll costs? Ludicrous stuff, says Dan in Cork. What do you say to that?
I can come in into that. So many of our nurses now, they will work a 3- and 4-day week. But what they have is they have compressed hours. So they're working very long days in those 3 or 4 days. That isn't a 4-day week the same as Tom works, because Tom is working the same number of hours in a 4-day, not five days worked over 4 days. So what it will mean for things like our health sector is that we reduce the length of those shifts over time. But this comes back to the thing about technology, of like getting the gains, the productivity gains from technology, that we're working smarter and the worker then is gaining that in free time.
Because we need to remind ourselves that there's no scientific basis to, which is an arbitrary thing, the 5-day week, you know, so we don't know if it's the best way to structure our work lives, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, we were told the wheels of industry would grind to a halt, but it's not working six days.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, like I'm sure, Ray, maybe at the start of your working life or speaking to your parents, working Saturday was just standard practice. You might have had a shorter working day on a Saturday, but a Saturday was just a normal part of the working week. And we're only talking 3-4 decades. There was a lot of pushback against it, including within the trade union movement themselves and around tradespeople as well, because it was felt like, how will we ever get a job finished if we're doing these, you know, part-time hours of a mere 40-hour week and things like that. So it does take time for people to evolve their thinking. But now imagine trying to get rid of the weekend, the standard weekend. People would be up in arms about it. So we very quickly adopt to things that have been century old. We are creatures of habits. You know, we can learn new habits as quickly as we can learn bad habits as well. And that's what it's about.
Colm says the ancient Celts had a 3-day weekend. On Ina was their day of religious observance, and the two preceding days were days of rest and preparation for the Ina, which is Friday. Hence on Caodin first, on Daredin second, and then on Ina, the feast day. So our ancestors were well ahead of us, says Colm. And Fintan says, I work for a wonderful company, Boston Scientific in Galway. This is nothing new in the factory setting. I currently work weekends, which is a 2-day week consisting of 2 12-hour shifts, and I'm off Monday to Friday, which is hugely beneficial to family life, says Fintan. So that works for him. And of course, all of this, it may not work for certain sectors and for certain people, but it'd be great if there was a lot more flexibility and variety and options for people that we weren't just dictated to about a 5-day week, I think. And Laura, you're just final one on this then. So you're constantly looking at this within your role in ICTU, head of social policy and social affairs. What way do you think it's going?
Well, the good news for listeners and for yourself is by the end of the year, so within the next month, we are going again. The EU is sending us over law around the right to request flexible working. So what's flexible working? It's not just working remote, that's part of it, but it is around requesting things like compressed hours, part-time work, job share, split shifts. And it is around exactly like what you said, helping people balance their home life with their work life. And where it is suitable and practical for the business, because we don't want to do things that are going to cost jobs and businesses, but where it can be done, we have to start moving away from that Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. And that's not just about office workers, that's about all type of workers, because recently we've been talking a lot about the rights to work from home and work remote, but now we're broadening that conversation and talking about rights around flexible working, changing work patterns, when you work, where you work and how you work. That's the next big phrase, and it's happening. The future is now. That's going to be happening over the next months and the next years.
Okay. Dr. Laura Bambrick, Head of Social Policy and Social Affairs at ICTU, thank you. And Tom Cranley, the 4-day week man, every Friday off. Thanks to you, Tom, as well. Thank you both. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we had a problem with our phone lines, so we better do this again. Yeah, we're looking for 2 people to come on after 4 o'clock and take part in our Reeling in the Years quiz. There is a prize, which is a 2-night stay for 2 people in Fota Island Resort. And today's qualifying question, Matilda the Musical has opened in the cinemas. Is it based on a book by Roald Dahl or David Williams? Matilda the Musical has opened in the cinemas. Is it based on a book by Roald Dahl or David Williams? 0818 715 925. 0818 715 925. Now, 5155 on Ray at RTE.ie. A powerful documentary will hit selected Irish cinemas this week. It's called How to Tell a Secret. It explores the experiences of people who are living with HIV in Ireland today. With me in studio is Robbie Lawler, who tells his personal story in the movie. How are you doing, Robbie?
How are you doing, Ray?
And the co-director of the documentary, Sean Dunn. How are you doing, Sean?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in. Congratulations on the documentary.
Thank you.
It all started because, Robbie, you had to tell Sean your secret. And let's get straight in there. Let's get straight in.
Oh, yeah. It's obviously not a nice thing to do. But so when I was 21, I got HIV diagnosis. And I had 5 previous sexual partners. And I was up late at night just worrying. I was like, well, I didn't know anything about HIV and I wasn't sure if my previous partners did. And so I was losing sleep. I'm like, I have to tell them because my immune system was actually badly hit by HIV. And I didn't want that for all my past relationships. Mm. So Sean was one of the five. We were seeing each other for a few months and I met people in different places, but I chose the very romantic spot of Eddie Rockets on O'Connell Street to tell Sean. I thought it was safer to be in public. So yeah, I sat him down, we got chocolate malts and I said, look, Sean, I have something to tell you. It's probably not the best thing to hear from an ex, but I just got a HIV diagnosis.
Right. Did you expect that was coming, Sean?
I was a little bit nervous because we hadn't spoken in a while. So when he got in touch, I was like, it's either to apologise or he's got bad news. so when we met up, yeah, I had a slight feeling and it was something that was on my mind anyway. I hadn't been tested in a while and we'd had unprotected sex, so it was on my mind. But, you know, when he sat across from me, I was just really grateful that he took the time to have that conversation with me person to person, even though it was under the garish lights of Eddie Rockets.
And what went through your head? No anger? No,
I wasn't angry because I wasn't sure who had brought it into the relationship. But so
that was your first sexual encounter, was it?
Not my first encounter. Probably the first time I had unprotected sex.
Right.
But I wasn't angry. I definitely got a bit anxious and got a bit worried. But, you know, at the same time, there was no confirmation that I had HIV. So really what was in front of me was somebody who had been diagnosed. So that really became the kind of crux of the conversation. And it really brought us together.
I just want to give a shout out to Sean here because, you know, it's a really nerve-wracking thing telling someone, you know, I have HIV, you could have potentially gotten it off me. Do you know, yes. That was the whole crux of it. But the minute I said it, like Sean just put his arm straight over to hold my hand and was like, are you okay? His first instinct was to see if I was okay rather than the shock or anger or any of those things that you may think comes up. And for me, as someone who was just diagnosed trying to overcome all of this, it was a really, I suppose, healing experience for me. Do you know that people can be like that, great in the world, and is that all stigma?
And do you mind me asking, how did it go with the other four?
To be honest, you were all great. As I was saying, you know, I had good relationships with all previous ones. One wasn't great, okay? But I never feel angry at people who have bad reactions because it's probably new to them. They're in shock. And sometimes people lash out at those moments. But I have to say, after the time I was on Tommy Tiernan, he came to me and he's like, Robbie, it's been on my mind for years. I just really want to apologise for how I reacted then. Do you know? So there's always room for growth with people. There was one negative one, but the rest are pretty good.
So you are living with HIV for 10 years?
Like a decade now.
A decade.
Oh my God, Ray, I show my age. But 1/3 of my life I live with HIV, which is quite wild, actually.
Yeah, and that's the important word, isn't it? Living with.
Oh, thriving with.
Thriving with
HIV, right? Because people associate HIV with, like, you know, doom and gloom or social death. And to be honest, it's given me so much to be blessed. Like, I feel blessed.
Just by listening to you and looking at you in the documentary, it has embellished your life because of what you've done. Because you say, there's a lovely quote in it where you say, I want to be the person I wish I'd met when I was diagnosed with HIV. So you do peer support.
Yeah, living with HIV can be quite a lonely experience, okay? Because a lot of people keep the secret. I say in the movie, you know, society has silenced us because when I was diagnosed with HIV at the age of 21, I didn't know one person living with HIV. Not one. And I say it was like living through an epidemic of silence rather than an epidemic of HIV, which was the worst part because medically we're there, okay? We have so much different medications. It means we can live as long as anyone else, very healthy life. And it means we can't pass on HIV sexually, okay? So the risk is zero. But socially it was very difficult because when you just get a chronic health like diagnosis, right? Especially one that is stigmatized as HIV, it's a very lonely journey unless you know someone in the same boat. And although there were thousands of us living with HIV in this country, not one person was really open about it or consistently open about it. And I think that's a real, like, just symbolised the stigma, the level of stigma in Ireland. So through my journey of meeting people and just hearing stories and just seeing the humanity behind HIV and just people living with HIV just getting on with their lives, but hearing their stories of stigma, it really just made me get up and get out and share my story because we shouldn't have to live in silence and people just need to know that we're just people getting on with our lives. That's literally it.
But the other side of it is that you, I suppose, are a little bit uncomfortable parading your trauma out over and over again, which you have, The Late Late Show, Tommy Tiernan, you're here in the documentary. And you would prefer that there was education around it, that it's somebody else's responsibility, not Robbie Lawler's.
Yes, basically. I'm only one person. Look, there's a bigger community of people coming out now with HRV, like Veda, my co-host of the Positive Vibe podcast, doing stellar work as well, who's also heavily featured in the movie. Mm. But like, a few people can't change a nation. I can't educate a nation. We need help from the government through education. We need parents to talk to their kids. We need kids to talk to their parents. We need, you know, people in the media to talk us on. And that's why I'm really grateful to be here. It needs to be a group effort, because ultimately we've never had higher HIV rates than we do today. Okay, ever before. There are thousands of us living with HIV. And as we know from, COVID-19, no one's safe till everyone's safe, essentially. It rings true for HIV. We need everyone to feel empowered to get tested, know their status, go on treatment, become undetectable, they can't pass on HIV, okay, and we won't have new HIV infections. But we also need to make Ireland a better and safer and happier place for all thousands of us living with HIV in this country. And it should not be down to a select few people. Everyone has sex in this country. So why isn't everyone being educated about sex?
And the two U's are important, undetectable and untransmittable.
Yes.
They're the two big. And this how to tell a story is going to go a long way in educating people who up until now wouldn't have been aware of the stories out there and the large stigma and the number of people who are living with HIV and haven't told anybody. It's the coming out part of it. It's like coming out for the second time if you're a gay person.
Yeah, 100% is. And I think what's amazing about the film that we've made is that you get to hear from so many different perspectives. Yeah. So we've got Robbie, we've got Veda, but we also have migrant women who are very heavily presenced, Irish women, people from rural Ireland. So there's a real myriad of voices in the film, and you get to understand how people are living, what their lives are like, and the other things that are happening at the same time. You know what I mean? Like, there's a broader life out there for everybody. And I think our film kind of just gives us all a window into some very specific experiences.
Why do you think the numbers are higher than ever before, Robbie?
People could do a PhD in this question, right? There's a few reasons, okay? One was during COVID-19, we shut down all sexual health services or heavily restricted them for 2 years. 2 years. Think about it is, when you have HIV, you can go for years without feeling sick until you get an eighth to final illness, until it eventually brings your immune system so low you're open up to infection. So people aren't getting tested. They don't know their status. That means they're more likely to pass it on. And people are still having sex during COVID-19. Mm. Okay, so that's one issue. The other thing is, there's a thing called transference of care. So you could be from Latin America, Eastern Europe, Sub-Saharan Africa. And if you get a diagnosis there and you live with HIV there, but you come to Ireland, you could be considered one new diagnosis here. Okay, so there's loads of different reasons that we can imagine. But the fact is that they're still stubbornly high, the numbers, for what it should be, because we have a thing called PrEP, which is a HIV prevention medication. Okay?
Prophylactic.
Pre-exposure prophylaxis, exactly.
So it means that if you're, say, planning on having sex over a weekend, you can take this on the Friday or... And that makes you safe for the weekend, is that it?
Basically, well, yeah. So it's like the contraceptive pill, okay? Yeah. People with vaginas versus people who have anal sex can take it differently because of the absorption of PrEP. So I say talk to your sexual health doctor about that. However, it kind of works the same in terms of contraception. Like, if you're exposed to HIV but you have enough PrEP in your system, you will not get HIV. Mm. The problem is we don't have enough PrEP clinics in Ireland. It's already full up. Even though we have stubbornly high HIV rates. So we need to get better infrastructure, sexual health infrastructure, to get more people on PrEP. And it shouldn't be just gay men, white gay men on this. You know, it should be opened up to everyone who needs it.
In the documentary, they show clips of health information ads from back in the 80s. They were quite stark. Mm-hmm. There's one with a heterosexual couple playing cards, and then they're talking about casual sex, and then she or he turns over one of the cards and there's a skeleton on it, and AIDS is written across in bold. And I think the voiceover goes, if you have casual sex, you get AIDS or something like that. So we haven't seen anything like that for a long time. So how do we get the message out? Because as well as reducing the stigma around HIV, maybe safe sex is a message we need to get out as well, is it?
For sure, and just I think testing as well. Like, at the moment with our film campaign, like, on the back of our flyers, we have information about home testing. Mm. You know what I mean? And I think, like, as much as we can partner with each other as possible to kind of help deliver those messages, like, it's quite easy to get a test nowadays. Like, you can get it sent to your house, you can send it back. It's not that much hassle. It can be for free. So, I think that message needs to be delivered more and more.
I think so. sh24.ie, free at-home testing kits from the HSE. They literally bring a test to your door through the post. You self-swab and you send it back through the post, all free of charge, and you get your results back in a week. Mm. So I didn't even need to take half a day to go to a sexual health clinic anymore. There's no excuse.
So you are that person you wanted to be, the person who you wish you'd met when you got a positive test.
Yeah, it's a bit wild.
How many people do you reckon you've met in the last decade?
Oh, I know hundreds of people living with HIV in Ireland and around the world. And let me just tell you, that's why I say HIV is the biggest gift. Because HIV, I wouldn't have known them otherwise. Mm. And I think HIV, living with HIV can be a real dehumanizing experience, okay? I always say HIV stands for human immunodeficiency virus, but people forget the H all the time. Human, you see, as immunodeficiency virus. And I think through storytelling, through education, as you alluded to earlier, it's the best campaign tool we have because it just shows that we're just humans, you know, again, bringing back the H into HIV. So I think that's kind of a big part of it all.
And your immune system was pretty shot when you got diagnosed. And if it goes a certain distance, then it transforms into AIDS.
Potentially, yeah. Right. HIV always wins, okay?
What do you mean it always wins?
It always wins as in, like, it depends on your genetics, okay? So when I have HIV in my body, I had it since I was 18. So my immune system was quite low, and they said I was around 6 months to potentially develop an AIDS-defined illness, which is quite a scary thing to hear from at the age of 21. But depending on your immune system and your genetics, you could live with HIV for 5, 10, 15, 20 years without developing an AIDS-defined illness, but it will always get to AIDS eventually. You know, so
well, not with you because you're taking medication.
Because I'm taking medication. Because what the medication does is it stops HIV from replicating. So it dies if it can't replicate, but it lies asleep in different parts of my body. Uh-huh. So that's why it's asleep in my gut, in my brain, in my spine. So I take my medication every day to make sure it remains asleep.
But it's undetectable. If you went for a test, it would say that you don't have HIV or. Is that the undetectable part of it?
Yes, exactly. So if you want to look for HIV specifically, you can't find it. It's to undetectable levels. And because it's so low in my semen or in vaginal fluids, it just means we cannot pass on HIV sexually at all. The risk is absolutely zero. And we can have kids without passing on HIV, which is huge. Because for so many women living with HIV, that's the biggest fear as well. And a lot of women find out they live with HIV when they're pregnant because HIV is a test that they do during pregnancy. So it's a big shock for a lot of women.
What about the person who you got it from? Does that person feature in your life? Are you in any way, do you think about them? Did you think about them? Were you angry?
God, no. I can't say no. They don't feature in my life, but I wish them well. I always say there's three freedoms when you live with HIV. And one of the biggest freedoms is when you stop feeling angry about why did I get this or how did I get this. It's the biggest freedom. When I say in my life, something really crappy happened, I'm going to move on with my life. I'm going to like make the rest of my life amazing. I'm not going to let the virus win. For me, that's the biggest freedom. So I only wish that person all the best. And I hope that they're well along on their journey as well.
Because there is anger depicted in the film, isn't there? There's a guy who takes a sledgehammer to a car. I don't know if that is that's sort of
poetic,
a dramatic
poetic representation. Yeah, no one actually smashed up a car.
No.
But we wanted to kind of represent that initial experience of shock and rage. And for us, you know, Anna Rogers and I, we directed the piece together. The car represents the journey you're on in your life and that feeling of just disruption and having to stop and chaos. But like, luckily, especially with, you know, that perspective with Aaron's story, that's Aaron's story in the film, you get to see that story come full circle and move away from anger and move into a kind of a celebration, like a phase of celebration, which I think is really important. Like Robbie's saying about the freedom that comes with acceptance and finding people that you can connect with.
Now, it's in cinemas, but it strikes me as a documentary that should be shown in secondary schools because you're constantly talking about education in the documentary. Do you think that would ever happen?
It's something that we're definitely very interested in and something we're having conversations on all the time. And it's up to the schools to kind of, you know, listen up and take it on board and find a meaningful space for the conversation to be held within the curriculum, I think. So, it's definitely something that we're super interested in moving forward.
What about you? Because it's a really well put together piece. That's not very articulate, but you know what I mean. You obviously have a talent.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm working with an amazing team: Anna Rogers and Zlata Filipovic and Eleanor Bowman, the director of photography, did such an incredible job. So we're continuing to work together on some new feature projects in the future, and hoping to continue to make work that feels like meaningful and artful. And brings the whole community together.
I want to give a shout out to Sean because he is HIV negative and the whole team is HIV negative.
Yes.
But yet, it's mission orientated. They're doing this and we're doing it like on peanuts, right? Like we're very happy with the funding that we got, but it's not a lot of money. And we've done it over COVID, so there's a lot of stressors there as well. So it's definitely like a passion project because they really believe that these stories need to be told. So again, it kind of comes out to the community helping and sharing this message as much as possible. Like Sean, Anna Zlata, Eleanor.
coming to see it this week. Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, especially on World AIDS Day, it would be amazing to have as many people in that cinema as possible.
So it's in cinemas in Dublin, Cork, Galway and Wexford from this Thursday, which is World AIDS Day. Thanks very much, Sean. Thank you. Well done. Thanks very much, Robbie.
Thanks so much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you very much. 51551 Ray at RTE.ie. Just a few more texts on the four-day week. You want to go shopping 7 days a week, go to a restaurant on the weekend, building a hospital taking 20% longer because everyone's on a four-day week. It's silly, says Dan. And LOL, maybe your guests could take a look at the haulage industry. 48 hours is a fantasy in our line of work, says that person. And then an unnamed texter. I'm retired, Ray, but when I was employed and they spoke about cutting back to a three-day week, I used to say I wasn't going to work an extra day for anyone. So there you have it. Yeah, it's a chat that's you'll be hearing a lot more of over the coming months and years, I'd say. Well, I know. Now it's time for our quiz. We have two quizzers standing by and we have a prize. And this week's prize is a two-night stay for two people in the Fota Island Resort. And relax in luxury in one of the gorgeous suites overlooking 780 acres of lush countryside. And there's loads of things to do down there. There's a spa, there's golf, there's the wildlife park, and then there's loads of dining options, and then there's loads of places to visit. You can go into Cork or go out to Ballycotton, all those places. Fotaisland.ie, Fotaisland.ie for more information. Hello, Tracy McDermott.
Hello, Ray, how are you?
Not too bad. You're in Wexford.
I am.
Whereabouts in Wexford?
Near a place called Tegoat, which is near Rosslare Strand.
What's the first place you said?
Tegoat.
Tegoat?
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
T-A-G-O-A-T.
Are you going to Tegoat? Are you going to Tegoat? Is that, that's the way you'd say it, isn't it? Are you going to Tegoat?
Yeah, I'm only a blow-in now, so right. I can't comment. I can't comment on the name of the village.
Right. So when did you first go to Tegoat?
Probably about, actually 11 years ago this January.
Right. Okay. Where were you before that?
I was in Waterford, but I'm originally from Galway.
Right. You're a much travelled woman.
Yes.
And you're preparing for Christmas because you're making Christmas wreaths.
I am indeed, yeah. Yeah.
And have you done this every Christmas for a while?
I think the last four Christmases now I've been making wreaths for sale.
Yeah.
I am a flower farmer, so when the flowers stop growing in October, this is a nice way to supplement the income.
Mm. I think wreaths are having a moment, are they, Tracy? Or?
I think so, yeah. I do think so, yeah. They're everywhere, they're everywhere. But they're very nice, though.
Yeah. And are you, is it holly-based wreath or what?
No, it's kind of, well, I kind of do try to get them as natural as possible. So I'd kind of forage around the place or I'd borrow from people's gardens or stuff like that. Like, so
Hold on. You borrow from people's gardens. What, do you give it back then after Christmas, do you?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of like a symbiotic relationship.
Right, because okay.
If I go in for under plants for them, they'll grow better the next year.
Aha, right. So what sort of plants are you using in your reeds then?
Well, the ones I'm making at the moment now, they have a dogwood and willow base. Mm. So I get the dogwood up near Inniscorthy and the willow off a man called Ian. And then the moss is from the mountain. And then I grow my own eucalyptus. And then the fir, the Christmas trees are from a man named Pat.
Right.
And the holly is from Molly. And
from Molly. The holly's from Molly.
No, from Molly.
Molly, from Molly, right.
Molly,
okay,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. If you're going to get the holly from somebody, you better, it should be Molly,
I know,
shouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, the holly's from Molly. Yeah. And the Christmas trees are from a man called Pat, and they all deliver it to Tegoat. It's great. It's how many will you make in total?
Somewhere over 50.
Right, somewhere over 50. Not saying any more, in case anybody's
listening. Yeah, exactly.
Right, you're up against Lisa Mulholland in Knocknacarra. How are you doing, Lisa?
Hi, Ray. How are you doing?
Good. I'm feeling better. Thanks for asking. No, you weren't asking.
Oh, yeah.
No,
it's turmeric and ginger and cayenne pepper help you?
Yeah, it's a 2 or 3 day thing, but I'm up at about 75% now. What are you up to today? Good.
So I have a day off today. I work in the local hospital here in Galway, University Hospital. Mm. I'm a phlebotomist. I take the bloods in there.
Ah,
that's
yes,
what I do.
Yes, now there's a job. It wouldn't suit everybody.
No. It takes practice. It takes practice.
Yes. What's your strategy now? Because it's about distraction, isn't it? Isn't that that's.
It is. Well, I don't know. I think make the patient feel comfortable,
yes.
And, you know, tell them your name and get them comfortable and ask them if they have ever fainted before.
Right. That's important.
That's the first thing.
Yeah. And do you do the deep breath thing? Is that what you do or what do you
do? Yeah, take a deep breath and I usually say on three. One, two and three and you go.
Right. And would you not cheat and do it at two?
Yeah, for someone I didn't like, yeah. Maybe.
Yes, you do. Well, that's probably a better way because they're anticipating on three and then you just go, oh, there you go. He didn't even notice it. Are you originally a nurse then? Is that it? And you're going to...
I am, yes. Yeah, I trained as a nurse way back. And then when my son Daniel was born, I changed over then to phlebotomy. The hours are just more regular. Do you know, there's no night duty.
Yes, of course.
So it's more conducive to family life.
And what age is your son now?
Oh, Daniel is 17, so he's in 5th year. Two more years in school.
Collected him and...
Collected him. He's training tonight. He plays soccer and Gaelic. He's a great lad.
Yeah. Sorry to hear about your dad. So it was only 6 weeks ago.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ray.
So that Christmas is going to be a little bit sadder than, you know... It'll be tough.
Yeah, but we'll all be around. My mom is close by, so... I have two brothers here in Galway and a sister in Dublin. So we'll all come down and there's 10 grandchildren between everyone. Yeah.
Right.
So was it
sudden or?
No, it wasn't. Yeah. Poor dad had pancreatic cancer.
Oh,
so.
Jeannie Mac, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, this summer he just got quite bad. Yeah.
So
we've great memories of him.
A long goodbye. Yeah. You had a chance to say goodbye.
He was a great
anyway.
Character. Yeah, we did.
John Mulholland, R.I.P.
That's
okay.
Right. Oh, thank you.
Right. Now, it's nice to remember people, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
Now, three questions each. It seems odd going into this, but three questions each. And if you go for a long clip, you get a point. Go for a shorter clip, you get 2 points. And whoever gets the most on points is the winner. However, if it's a draw, we go to a tiebreak question. Good luck to you both. Here we go.
Thank you.
Tracy.
Okay.
The year is 2001, which is all of 21 years ago. And we're starting at the movies. Now, would you like a long clip or a short clip?
A short clip, please.
Short clip, right. This 2001 film follows a young boy as he discovers he's a famous wizard and begins his formal wizarding education. So, short clip for 2 points.
You've made a mistake. I mean, I can't be a wizard.
Harry Potter?
Yes, Harry Potter. The first of the Harry Potters back in 2001. You get 2 points for that. Now, Lisa, still on the movies from 2001. Do you want to go long or short?
I'll go short, Ray, thanks.
Okay, this romantic comedy starred Renee Zellweger, a single woman over 30 who was determined to improve herself while she looked for love in a year. Here's your short clip. Can you name the movie?
I have two choices, to give up or not. And this time I choose not.
Well...
Bridget Jones' Diary.
Is the correct answer. Well done. Hard to believe that's 21 years ago. Okay, so good start from both of you. Tracy, back to you. Music from 2001. Long or short?
Short, please.
Okay, this song was a huge hit for an Irish singer back in 2001. Can you name him or the song? I'm there, so let's not go
forgetting what we had. Ronan Keating?
It is Ronan Keating. I wouldn't have got that now. 2 points. Well done. Lisa, to you.
Okay.
What are you going to go for?
I'll go short clip.
Short again.
Please.
This is another Irish singer, and this song was the third single from their debut album. So can you name her or the song? Here's your short clip.
Samantha Mumba?
It is Samantha Mumba. I wouldn't have got that either. Well done. Always come back to your love. 2 points there as well. You're very evenly matched. Down to the wire, Tracy. It's news and current affairs. Do you want long or short?
Short, please.
Short. You had to think about that. In 2001, after 15 years of planning and consultation, a new form of transportation was finally available to view at St. Stephen's Green in Dublin. Have a listen to the clip, see if you can tell me what this new transportation was. Short clip.
The carriages in Lilac are, according to the project managers, designed to reflect the light in Dublin on a summer's evening.
Nice.
The Lewis.
It is the Lewis, yes. Clean sheet for you, 6 out of 6. You can't do any more. Lisa, you sort of have to go short, don't you?
Yes, I'll go short.
Right. If you get this right, we're into a tie-break situation. In 2001, many fans were left disappointed when tickets sold out in record time for an Irish band at Slane Castle. Have a listen. Can you name the band?
Many fans had queued all night in the hope of getting tickets. Their hopes were dashed within 45 minutes.
So an Irish band at Slane Castle.
Oh, and I guess you two?
Good guess. It's correct. Two points. Well done.
Oh, okay.
Well done. Now, that's 6 out of 6 for you both. So, Lisa and Tracy, we have to go to a tie-break question. We asked you this before you went on air. I'm going to say it again for our listeners at home. And whichever answer is closest to the correct answer is today's winner. Now, according to Google Maps, how long would it take you to drive from Dundrum Shopping Centre in Dublin to Mahon Point Shopping Centre in Cork? Your guess, Tracy?
3.5 hours.
3.5 hours, you say. It's 255.8 kilometres. And your guess, Lisa?
It was 3 hours 15 minutes.
3 hours. You did say 3 hours 15 minutes. The correct answer is 2 hours and 35 minutes. So, Lisa, you're closest to the correct answer. Tracy.
Oh, that's grand. Well done, Lisa.
Tracy.
And Tracy, another day, 6 out of 6 would have won it for you, but you're up against a good opponent today. We're going to send you out a Ray Darcy Show Keep Cup.
Deadly, thank you.
And good luck with the reeds.
Thank you.
Great talking to you, Tracy. Bye now. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Lisa, well done.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy.
Yes. So that's a lovely prize. A two-night stay for two people in Photo Island. Loads of things to do down there. And you can go to photoisland.ie. Wow is right. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Because I entered a couple of years ago, Ray, and I lost on the tiebreaker question.
There you go. So it's the tiebreaker again. Live by the sword. Live by the tiebreaker, die by the tiebreaker. Okay. Well done, Lisa.
Thank
good
you
talking
very
to you.
Much.
Enjoy it. See you now. Bye.
Oh,
bye.
Thanks. Bye, Ray.
Bye.
Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, earlier this month, Mary Pyle became the oldest graduate at Trinity College Dublin in all of its 400 years history, completing her PhD on J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter. Her PhD was based on an interesting premise. Why are the Harry Potter books, which are written for children, so popular with adults? And Mary joins me in studio. Good afternoon, Mary.
Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Now, how does that sit with you? The oldest graduate at Trinity College in
It's an odd kind of thing to get. I thought if people liked the thesis, that's grand. But to get just to be the oldest in 400 years, still, I suppose it's saying something.
It's saying something about you.
Yes, perhaps.
So you're 84.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about you then before we get to the thesis. And how did you end up doing a PhD completed when you were 84?
Well, I wanted to do a major piece of work. I had wanted to do that since I did my undergraduate study because it happened that my final year I wasn't able to study what I wanted because there weren't any lectures then. So it was kind of put on hold while I worked and brought up children and moved around the place.
Oh, hold on. So your undergraduate, when did you do that?
1960.
Okay. Well, that's in fairness to you, you're a woman of your word to yourself. So you put it on hold from 1960.
Yes.
Wow. And of course, I don't know if J.K. Rowling was born in 1960, was she?
Something like that, yes.
Yes, she around then, yeah. So you put it on hold and eventually came back to it.
Well, I didn't know it was going to be on J.K. Rowling.
No,
I just thought I would like to get stuck into something that really did take over and did occupy me and that I really could study and do.
And it was through your grandchildren that you were introduced to J.K. Rowling.
Yes, I got the books for them and then I found I was reading them and then I enjoyed them very much. And then my partner also liked them very much and he's from a completely different background as a marine biologist. So I thought there must be some reason why all these adults are reading the books.
Mm.
And there were lots of adults producing books on Harry Potter. So there had to be a reason why they were intrigued by it.
I remember visiting my brother in New York, and he'd come in on the train, and he had an adult book, but inside it, he had Harry Potter. This was in the early days,
yes.
Because he was embarrassed.
Oh, well, that was why Bloomsbury then brought them out in two editions, the adult edition and the child edition.
Different covers?
Different covers,
right.
Same text.
So they saw there was a demand from an adult audience?
They did, yeah.
Okay. So your background is in psychotherapy. That's your day job?
That's my day job.
And you still do that?
And I still do that, yes.
So through your studies and your understanding of psychotherapy and the subconscious, you brought that to the thesis?
I did. I took it from the point of view that there are some issues that we all face, both in childhood and as adults. And I think anybody who's looked at it at all psychoanalytically will say, yes, there is always issues of doing right and wrong or wondering about this or that. And they are very important at certain stages of childhood. So I tried to look at how they might be addressed in childhood, but also bringing in the fact that adults can also relate to these things.
Right. So let's talk specifically then about the themes. So death is one of the themes.
Death is, and I don't think everybody recognises it, and that's absolutely fine. I mean, younger children just read that people die and that's fine. But she herself, Rowling herself, says her books are all about death. And it does begin with Harry's death, Harry's parents' death.
Yeah.
And goes on to Harry sacrificing himself, but he doesn't actually die. So it's a theme that goes right through. And I think behind it all are things like, do relationships last after death or don't they? She says that she's a believer. And she probably is, but what is
she believes in an afterlife?
She does. She's right. A Christian, she says, okay. And a practicing Christian, but she doesn't specify any particular religion, which is why it can be read by anybody. I think the main principles of relationship and friendship go right through everything.
It's interesting. We were talking to a children's novelist recently. I can't remember who it was, but they said the first thing you do in a children's book is get rid of the parents.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah.
So that's obviously a common trope. So you talk about play as well, and there's an awful lot of talk about play for adults recently, that we need to do more of it.
Yeah. Well, just Winnicott always maintained that the basis of every
Who's
relationship...
Who's Winnicott?
Donald Winnicott. Right. He was a psychoanalyst. And his major book was Playing and Reality, because he felt that through play was how people could be fully themselves and could relate to people. And so I used that a lot in the thesis about how the children related, but also how readers relate to the protagonists in the book.
Yeah, because I suppose we play less and less as we get older, don't we?
Well, he would say that everything we do is play. You know, if we are listening to a concert, that is play. Or go to the theatre, that is play. Not just the play itself, but it is something which we share.
Yes, so leisure activity is
leisure
play.
Leisure activity,
is play,
it's a different kind.
Now, you the Dementors, this is interesting, because you sort of see Dementors as a representation of depression.
I do, yes.
So these are these wispy, dark figures that go around the place, like ghosts.
There are lots of ghosts in the Potter books, but the Dementors are different. They're much more solid. They're more like zombies, I think. You know, sort of scaly hands, and nobody ever sees their faces.
Yes.
And as soon as they appear, everybody feels cold and depressed, and a feeling that you can never be happy again. And really, that's quite a good description of depression, the feeling that you can never be happy again.
Yes. So that's horror sort of equivalent of the Black Dog.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. So back to you. I suppose I will ask you what's next. But you've kept yourself constantly busy.
Well, I want to make it into a book for a start.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. And Routledge are interested, but I've got to fill out a proposal for them.
Right.
And then see if they really would like to publish it.
Right, so that's the next project.
That's the next project.
Because I know you learned how to play the cello at 60.
Yes.
The age of 60.
Yes.
Yes, right.
My mother thought I was too old at 15.
There you go. So I suppose, do you have a bucket list, Mary? Do you have things?
No,
you,
no. I don't. But things come up and I think I will do that.
Yeah. And the psychotherapy, so that's, you're still doing that. It's psychotherapy.
Yes, I mean, mostly now what I'm doing is some teaching and supervising trainees. And that's the main part of the work I'm doing at the moment.
So in being active this late into your life, can you outline the benefits as you see them?
Well, I'm not bored.
That's fair enough.
Which I think is the first one.
Yes, yeah.
And also, you meet different people. I mean, learning the cello, I went on a couple of courses with children. There were three of us. One of us was a viola player and the other was a bass player and myself. And we joined in these courses for a week with the children. And it was really great fun because you kind of watch them and they're far better than you are. But it just sort of mixes up the generations in a way that is fun.
And we hear an awful lot about, you know, staving off Alzheimer's and dementia and learning a musical instrument is one of the things that's recommended. Of course, you don't know. We don't know if it's worked for you or not. That's the thing, isn't it?
Well, exactly.
So we don't have any scientific research. But what do you think? You know, well, you would know from your contemporaries, not saying that they have dementia, but you would know how they behave.
Well, I think so, because I have a couple of friends who are about 10 years older than I am, but they kind of gave up about 10 years ago and really didn't do anything much, which I felt was really, really sad because they were very bright people. And they certainly have kind of deteriorated into dementia, into not recognizing people anymore. I don't know if it would have been better if they'd kept doing things.
No, I suppose that thing that you said, which is sounds a little bit glib, but it's probably the answer is you're not bored. Do you know that's the thing we should aim not to
I
be
think
bored?
So, yeah.
I suppose.
I think what I mean by that is it doesn't really matter what you do.
Yes,
you know, whether you read or whether you write or whether you play an instrument, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you're enjoying it and enjoying life.
So I don't think your record is going to be broken anytime soon, Mary.
It nearly was.
Was it?
Well, no, there was somebody before me I just saw the other day. I think he was 81.
Right.
And he was from Japan and had finished his teaching career there and did a PhD. I think I'm right on that.
Okay. But he
hasn't got there yet.
Yes, and you'd put it off for what? What's that, 62 years?
Yes.
62 years. Yes. Put it on hold for 62 years. Mary Pyle, congratulations again. Thanks so much for coming in. That's it from us today. Cormac and Sarah are on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.
It's the Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.